Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And hello, everyone, for February 5th, 2023. This is a Sunday podcast with Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how you doing?
Chase, I'm awesome. Just another sweep for USC basketball. So we're in a really good spot here coming down the stretch. So excited to see the finish.
Yes, so it was a little dicey at times yesterday for a variety of reasons. We'll get into that in a second, but we did come away with the home sweep, which is basically taking care of business. We exited the weekend the same way we entered it, as far as like KenPom rankings and Torvik rankings. So we're basically in the same general ballpark. Moved up a little bit with Washington State, moved down a little bit with Washington. We both picked SC to win both games, and SC did win both games. So I guess we haven't had a pod. So let's talk a little bit about both games. The Washington State game was interesting. So I talked a little bit about this online, but my perception of watching that game against Washington State, they looked so precise on offense. Their screens were so crisp. Muhammad Gay, obviously, for three quarters of the game, looked like a all-American, just NBA guy, just looked phenomenal. We lose Josh Morgan early in that game, before I think even the first media timeout, right around that time. And he's out with looks like a really badly sprained ankle. Hopefully there's no ligament damage in there. It took a while for us to kind of get a full grasp on this. It was really, I think I texted you offline with about 4.5 minutes ago. I said, look, I think maybe Washington State is just the better team. But we put it together. Boogie hit some huge shots down the stretch. Drew hit an absolutely huge shot, matched up one-on-one on Gay to three to really put the game on ice. And we win. And, that was a testament to just our players making their play, playmaking. Come back against Washington and without Josh Morgan and without Reese Dixon Waters, who also kind of got rolled up in that Washington game. I think he'll be fine because he actually finished that game against Washington State, but did not suit up for the next game. And it was a lot of, just a little bit of a tougher game as far as not playing as strong of an opponent, kind of playing more down to their level. And Drew and Boogie just were ice cold from the outside. I think they were each, 4 for 14 from the field. Both missed a ton of threes. And we had to rely on Kobe and Trey to get it done and win that game. It was a game with really strange officiating, which I think you'll probably cover too, but took Washington's best player. Washington's best player is really not, in my opinion, Keon Brooks. It's either Minifield or Braxton Mia. But Braxton Mia kind of initiates foul contact on every single play, whether it's offense or defense. And the officials were calling everything. So he fouled himself out of the game, and he got, it put Vince in a position where Vince was almost couldn't play because he was in foul trouble the whole game. So we had to win that with really without Vince too. So we were really kind of like shorthanded in that game, managed to pull it off. And we come away with two wins. What are your thoughts from the two games, and what are your takeaways?
Yeah, I guess the biggest takeaway is I liked how we finished both games. We were actually they were both very tight with about 4 minutes to play. And unlike, some other games, we just hit the gas in the final four and got it done. I do think, our shot quality against Washington was really good. Like even on the Boogie and Drew Peterson missed shots, it's funny. They were both not only 4 for 14, but they were both 3 of 7 from two and 1 of 7 from three. So they played almost these identical shooting games. And yeah, we did make our free throws, 18 to 21. That was big against Washington. You mentioned the officiating, and I thought it was just horrendous. One of the worst officiated games I've seen it, this year in the Pac-12. We have a history with Vern Harris as an official, but it's never been that bad. Certainly not like Tony Padilla level that we've had in the past, but that was just an abomination. I mean, the flagrant foul on Vince, where they not only gave them the free throws, but they gave them the ball, almost negating like the Mia foul. Not for, not in terms of Mia's total fouls, but in terms of just like, he got fouls and then somehow, they end up with the ball and on top of the free throws. That was insane to me. What else? I did like the way we competed on the glass against Washington. That was better. They were a bad rebounding team, so that didn't really surprise me. And they lacked the size without Mia in the game. Part of the reason this game was as close as it was, too, is they just kept giving Keon Brooks call after call after call. I mean, they treated him like a superstar. The guy shot 13 free throws. It was absurd. But and Minifield hit a few shots. We did a pretty good job on their role guys. They had 10. He had some contested shots, one of them being that turnaround jumper over Trey White. We gave Fuller a straight line drive in the first half, for a left-handed layup. That wasn't great, but he didn't hurt us from three. His threes were contested. We did a pretty good job guarding the arc in that game. And then with Washington State, I thought Gay was just hitting everything in the first half. We did a better job in the second half of that game, kind of pressuring him a bit and getting him to be a bit turnover prone. And then also just forcing him to shoot like fadeaway contested jumpers over us. He hit a few of them, but those are generally low percentage shots. And we did a better job, I think, in the second half of kind of making him go full Kevin Durant to beat us. But yeah, overall happy with the efforts. I thought it was good to see us win that Washington game going for 22 from three. Just because we've been shooting the ball better lately, but that's not totally sustainable. Had this terrible shooting game and still pulled through. And just really the emergence of both Trey, who was awesome in transition. He was awesome as a cutter. Even in like ISO situations, he hit a few runners and pull-ups. Just really impressed with his effort. Also adding five boards and four assists. One of his better passing games of the year. And then we did share the ball really well against the zone, I thought. And then Kobe, I mean, what can you say? It's one of the best, I think, USC performances in the last few years. He scores 21 points on seven shots, goes 5 of 7 from the fields. Hit two late threes, 9 for 9 from the line, and then he's got five assists, four steals, and no turnovers on top of that. So just an exceptional effort from him. And yeah, overall, just happy with the wins.
On the officiating, just really briefly, it reminded me a little bit of the Colorado State game that I went to, where it really appeared like the officials didn't quite understand how to officiate these games. I guess there was a stat going that was mentioned during, I didn't realize this, during the telecast yesterday, where when SC fouls 20 or more times in the game, we were 0-4. Against Colorado State, we only fouled 18 and they fouled 20. So, but those are like, that was a very high foul game. That game, I went back and looked. There's a couple of the officials did, one of them looks like he works a little high major. One of them actually works some high major and does Big Ten games. And the third one did like no power conference games at all. Last night's game, these two other officials, obviously, we all know about Vern Harris. He does quite a bit of Pac-10 games, Pac-12 games, I mean, and does, Mountain West too, which is common. But he does enough. The other two officials, one of them, this was his fifth Pac-12 game of the season, and the other one, this was only his third. Those guys did not, I don't think they understand how to officiate. I think some of it is just not understanding how to officiate athletes at this level. Certainly, they didn't understand what was, how to officiate Mia and anyone trying to guard him, didn't understand how to officiate Keon Brooks. We actually did commit over 20 fouls in the game, 21 and one. Washington ended up committing 23, mainly because of a lot of the fouls at the end. So, the officiating was, I can't say it was biased. At one point during the game, I thought, oh, this is biased. But I think I just came away thinking it's lack of confidence, not really understanding what you're doing. So I don't want to get too far down the road. Actually, I'm kind of shocked because I think the officiating for the season has been much better than I anticipated, given that we announced that we're leaving the conference. I assumed it'd be a complete like disaster all the time. We've actually, I think, gotten some decent officiating, but it was really ugly last night, and it affected our ability just to kind of, just kind of cruise to what I think would have been like a 10-12 point win. Because of all the foul issues, especially compounded by the fact that Joshua Morgan wasn't giving us any minutes at all, which matters a lot. And it should be said, Washington was playing with not only with Cole Bajema, who I think could have made a difference in a game like that because he could hit some threes, and Washington, other than Minifield hitting some open threes, wasn't really hitting from the outside. And they're also missing Kepnaugh, who might be back for them next season, and that'd be an interesting guy for them to have. Certainly, when Mia's out, they have like no bigs that they play, so they're going small. So those are my thoughts, kind of there on that point. Kobe was amazing. Yes, absolutely. It is interesting going into next season, thinking, gosh, we'll have Kobe, Trey White, and Vince to pair with Collier coming in. Hopefully we can sustain that kind of core, because even though Drew and Boogie for the most part have been really playing great, they still do have their down games, and sometimes they have them together like yesterday with the shooting. We talked about how Kobe and Boogie had been really, not Kobe, I keep saying Drew and Boogie, sorry, Drew and Boogie have their off game shooting. They had been doing better managing turnovers, but they had seven turnovers combined yesterday, and that wasn't good either. So neither one really, not a really great game for either one of them. Drew played, I think, a little better just because he did get quite a bit of assists. He rebounded okay. He had a double double and was two assists away from a triple double, but had a couple blocks too. So he at least stepped the stat sheet. Boogie didn't really, he had a big key layup late in the game, which helped a lot, but. For the scoring, for the most part, we were relying on Trey White until the end of the game, and we were relying on Kobe, and that was kind of it. And we didn't have Reese to give us his extra minutes. So, we're really at this point like a seven-player rotation team, and we're missing two guys in the rotation, and that matters. I come out of that. I take the wins. I would have liked a better result yesterday, but I think we talked at halftime. We were in the first half. Our defense was absolutely stellar. I think we were giving up just above 0.7 points per possession to Washington. The offense wasn't great, but the defense was really stellar. And then the next 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes of the second half were not good on either offense or defense. And then, the officiating just got way too involved. And it just makes it tough to watch the game, tough to take an interest. I really dislike, too, that just, and I talked about this yesterday too. SC obviously has an issue with attendance. And as much as Galen Center, I think, has been a boon to our overall performance, and I think it's definitely helped bring out more students to games, it hasn't really produced a lot in terms of getting non-students to show up to games. In fact, in some ways, it was easier to go to the sports arena because there's better parking. You didn't have to deal with a parking situation you have at Galen. And I think that matters a little bit now, but just the traffic situation in Los Angeles is really terrible, and UCLA suffers from this as well. So just, the combination of all these factors. Well, there was a little bit of buzz going around after beating UCLA, and this was you know, the Washington State game, you know, you're just never, no matter how good Washington State is, you're never going to get as many fans who want to turn out for that game. So this was a good game to you. It was a weekend. People had more free time. I think there was a pretty good turnout. I have to check the actual attendance numbers. But then they show up and they see that kind of not so much performance by SC, but just like the entire package of what you're watching. And, you know, the terrible officiating and taking best, you know, people come out to see Vince play and he's barely playing because of the foul trouble. So I do wonder, like, gosh, how much is that going to affect people coming back to the next game? Unfortunately, you know, and when people talk about the quote unquote curse of USC basketball, actually not sure. Like, this season certainly doesn't feel cursed to me. I mean, we have a guy have cardiac arrest, and then he's coming back and playing. It's amazing, you know. So I think it's like kind of beating the curse back a little bit, to the extent there is one. But a lot of the curse is stuff like, you know, connecting with your fan base, getting the fans connected with the program, and it's always been a struggle. And in like a game like that, you know, it just attended. So yeah, 5,700 people. That's like one of our best attended games this season at Galen. 5,700 people. And I think a lot of them are so see that and they're like, I don't know if I want to come. I'm going to go through the big time investment to go back out to a game like that if, you know, it wasn't quite as fun as I thought it might be. I'm hoping that's not the case. I'm hoping we get fans turning out the rest of the season. But, you know, it's little things like that when, like, the fans are actually turn out to the game and the officials are just disaster, just complete disaster. And it's like a joke. I don't know. Maybe I should get off my soapbox, but that's just kind of one of my perceptions of watching that.
So there are a few kind of points to unwrap there, I think. First off, like the officials, we should get better officiating in the Big Ten, I'm hoping, at least. So that should, like, you're never going to get perfect college officiating. I mean, heck, like the NBA officials are much better than college and they're not perfect. You know, they had that missed call on the LeBron layup against the Celtics. I know that got a lot of hype. So that should help a little bit. And then also just the brand thing. I was talking with a few friends the other day, just even though like Washington State might be as good as Michigan this year, if you play Michigan at home, it just has a different feel than if you're playing Washington State at home, right? So I think that should help at least marginally with attendance. And the other thing too, I mean, you know, we had a 6-point win against Washington with some stellar individual performances with a 10-point spread. I mean, I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of there. And, you know, fans, if they see that and they don't want to come to another game, I mean, that's kind of on them. I'm not sure how much you can do about that, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think we did our, you know, guys rose to the occasion. You can't control shooting. I do think, by the way, the shooting thing, it was at least to me, it felt like Boogie and Drew were, even though they were open and they're getting high quality looks, it felt a little bit like they were out of rhythm and they weren't, especially against the zone, they weren't kind of getting the right momentum, like being able to step into shots the way they usually like to. It was a lot of like standing set shots because they were just standing there wide open, get the ball, and then just like have to shoot it. And especially for Boogie really prefers to like be able to just kind of step into a shot. Drew can do more of the kind of like fadeaways, but so it was just a little off, and I think that's why they're missing it. Kind of just it built on itself up over time, and Boogie just kind of lost confidence. So hopefully they get it back heading into the big trip up to Oregon. Do you want to talk about, we were talking just before the podcast started about Kobe and, you know, different things, yeah, like draft prospects. So why don't you like lay out your thoughts on that, and then I'll give you everyone some of my thoughts.
Yeah. So with Kobe, I think he might be playing himself into this year's draft. You know, the comparisons to D'Anthony, right, are going to get thrown around, I think justifiably so. They are like slightly different prospects for sure. I think Kobe's a little bit more accomplished as a shooter at this stage. Both have good mechanics that are projectable. Kobe also has a little bit more positional size, right? They, you know, Kobe's, he's more of a wing, right? He can guard get switched on to fours and not get destroyed. Whereas if DeAnthony got switched onto a four, you'd have a massive height disadvantage. So Kobe's a little more versatile that way. DeAnthony might be a little bit more better on ball against like quick point guards just because of his, he might have like a little bit more lateral quickness. Although Kobe's certainly no slouch in that area. You also have, DeAnthony had his performance as a freshman, whereas Kobe's having his as a sophomore. So you might think of it that way in the draft models as, DeAnthony being a little more bit more projectable, having a little bit more of a ceiling that way. But I do think it's interesting that Kobe hasn't really been brought up in that conversation, especially just given how good of a year he's had, really, really on both sides of the ball. I mean, he's made massive leaps on, as a defender, and certainly as a shooter and as a passer. So I don't know how it's going to shake out. Like, if I had to put my money on whether he'd be back next year, I think he will be back next year. But when you see performances like that, it does make you think, okay, maybe this becomes a discussion.
So in my we've been talking about this. I think there is a there's an interesting comp here for DeAnthony. Obviously, Kobe's doing this a year later. I think the separator to me is DeAnthony. One thing that DeAnthony can bring to the table is he can actually play point guard in the NBA, which Kobe cannot. You don't want him playing point guard. You don't want him facilitating the offense. Now, DeAnthony is by no means is he like some elite offensive facilitator at NBA level, but he can do it, and he's not going to negatively affect your team by doing it. You don't want Kobe doing that. I think the separator for Kobe then is if he is like a true wing three green D guy. I mean, his shooting efficiency is extremely high, but he's making fewer than less than 1 3-pointer per game. So I think he's got to raise that level. There's got to volume does matter a little bit in this scenario because it's so low. The efficiency is extremely high, but the volume is so low. It's hard to know what he would do it at a higher volume. So I think he's got to raise that a little bit. And we'll see, how that shakes out. And that's what I think is like, since he's not a point guard and he's got to be like a wing three and D guy, I think they need a little more volume on the shooting to know for sure. And he can get that next season, and he's definitely going to have the opportunity. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm looking at, he's not like, I think on ESPN's like top 100, he's not on the top 100 right now. I looked at the draft board for NBA draft.net. He's not, he's not mentioned there. Maybe he'll start getting some eyeballs. I think one of the issues though, it's an interesting year because there's a lot of like, even though there's like a lack of elite guys after like, let's say the top three, there's a lot of like parity, and it just kind of is filtered throughout this entire draft. So like a guy like Marcus Sasser, like, okay, what do you do with him? He can definitely play point guard, right? He can give point guard minutes at the NBA level. Tenacious guy, can play defense. He's definitely not a first round guy. He's a second round guy. So you're going to mix him in with other guys. And then you got guys like Grant Sherfield. I mean, I don't know where you place him. You think like, okay, well, this guy's definitely not an NBA level player. And then there's guys like Amani Bates who's falling to the second round. Like, I'm sure a team is going to take a flyer on him for sure, right? And then you've got all these bigs. Are they going to find homes? Drew Timmy, Oscar Tshiebwe, Amando Bacot, Muhammad Gay. Are those guys going to get drafted? So it's definitely a year. And then like I'm just like looking through it, like Isaiah Wong. Is he going to get drafted? So there's a lot of guys kind of in that range of okay, so Terrence Shannon. Are they going to find homes? I just don't know.
As
I
you
don't
know, it's
know.
Tubelis, right? Or
Oh,
something like
Tubelis. I mean, perfect. He
that.
goes. He's going to go perfectly with Timmy and Tshiebwe and. All those, so many bigs that are, and then like Jaime Jaquez finds himself in the stuck in the midst of that. And he's like, oh, I'm a little bit better outside shooter than those guys, but definitely not as long. So yeah, it is a weird year for a lot of very productive college players. You're wondering, okay, where do they find their spot in the draft, and will they find a spot in the draft? And we haven't even talked about like Edie, right? So would he
find right.
spot yep. of the draft? Okay, so let's maybe talk a little bit about Pac-12, what we're seeing now. Oregon was able to hold on at Tempe, beat Arizona State. That kind of puts them in the position where they're pretty much the fourth best team in the conference at this point, I think. SC is going to play up in Eugene. There's no return trip for the Oregon schools to LA this year. So this is the only meeting. I mean, Oregon's already played in LA in the early part of the conference.
Oregon State.
Oregon played UCLA and Oregon State played USC. There's no other return trip, right, for the other two, you know, for the other two games. So this is right. going to be our only game against Oregon. It's going to be a really important game. It's the only game where, like, Ken Pom projects SC to lose in the next four. I think this was going to tell us a lot about kind of where we are. I don't expect Joshua Morgan to play in this game. I'm hoping Reese will be back. But I could see it definitely like a same type of issue for Vince foul wise trying to guard Dante without help. If he doesn't have those, you know, minutes from Joshua Morgan, we didn't even play Johnny Wright yesterday. So we basically gave all those extra minutes when we're using bigs to Niagu and to Hornery, which I'm a little questioning that, because even though Kijani had struggled on the offensive end and kind of with rebound, he actually played decent defense against Gay when he had the opportunity to. I think this could be a tricky game. It's going to tell us, like, if Oregon wins that game, they're going to be making a play for third place in the conference, no doubt. If SC can win, I think that locks SC in the top three of the conference. Any thoughts more on that?
Totally agree. And I think we can stick a fork in the Sun Devils too, no pun intended.
Yeah, well, and, you know, they've now lost, what, 5 of 6. You know, not surprising given where they started the season. I think they're going to have to have a come to Jesus moment at some point here with Hurley, because, you know, even when they're starting 15-3, right? And just not getting anything done after that, losing to Washington on the road, I mean, that hurt a lot. Then you think at least come back and try to hold court hold serve against Oregon, and they didn't do it. So that's rough. You know,
what'd you think of the Luther Muhammad fadeaway three from the corner?
Yeah. So this is late in the game, and there was it was a turnover, right? They'd actually turn Oregon over. I think they were down by two at the point at that moment, and they come down a fast break and throw the ball off the wing, and Muhammad, who for some reason is even in the game now, granted, I guess he's pretty efficient but for the most part of the season, Hurley's not playing him for the most part. And he's in the game though, crunch time, and he shoots the three from the corner. It was not close, not remotely close. On a fast break, essentially. So
this was a three falling out of bounds from the corner, you know, for a guy that's 6 of 32 on the season from three and shot 19% last year from three. And they didn't need to shoot that shot. I mean, like, they had the ball, they could have, you know, moved the ball a bit, and it wasn't like a desperation shot at the end. It was I'm just going to pull up and shoot my, you know, fadeaway NBA three falling out of bounds. It was one of the craziest shots I've ever seen.
Yeah. And not to mention that, like, Arizona State was not exactly like setting the world on fire on offense otherwise. So, like, this was an opportunity to get a really decent shot rather than that shot, because they had numbers advantage. I don't know why he was in the game at all. But frankly, I know he had played pretty well for that moment in the game, but I still don't think you can want to rely on him going down the stretch. The Arizona State offense has kind of just collapsed, and which is not surprising. They don't really have stellar offensive players. And I think, what are they now? They're eighth in the conference in offensive efficiency in the in those conference only games. So they're just, look, it's another example of, I think, why it's a good idea for us to get out of this conference. Now, they actually had a stellar out of non-conference play this year, other than that one terrible loss they had to at Texas Southern HBCU school. But, you know, like, this was back to my hobby horse on the Washington thing going in. But, like, you know, those, a team that has the, like, the talent level of Washington cannot be losing all the, they, you know, losing to Cal Baptist at home, you know, losing, essentially losing to Auburn by 23 at home. You know, you got to do, you know, they lost to Oregon State to start the conference. You got to do more. You got to do more. And now they've lost four of the last five. They're 13-12. It's just, there's just not enough teams in the Pac-12 that take basketball seriously enough and that can keep up, you know, the performance throughout the season. And now we're seeing this Oregon team elevating itself. And this team is a out-of-conference disaster, losing to UC Irvine, losing to Utah Valley. They lost Colorado earlier in the season. They lost it, got blown out at home by Arizona State earlier. They just lost in Stanford on the road. So, and, you know, now they're going to be, you know, playing these games and they're going to have a chance to potentially win out. They got USC and UCLA at home. And after that, they, you know, they got five very winnable games. It just, the conference just has not, it's just not, you don't want to bet long on this conference. And I have to say, it's just, I'm so happy that the SC's day is coming to an end.
Yeah, you can even throw like Cal in there, right? So Cal started the year, their preseason prior in KenPom was 146. And then by the time they entered, this includes their two initial conference games, but by the time they entered like their third conference game in late December, they were 241 in KenPom. So they dropped.
Having lost every game but one.
Yes, they were 1-12, and their only win was UT Arlington, who's 269 in KenPom. So just a disastrous out of slate, you know, non-conference slate by Cal, and then Oregon State, right? Like, they lost two games to Portland State. And then they, you know, they've got three conference wins. Like, they beat Washington and Colorado, and then you've got, you know, you touched on Washington, the Oregon thing. Like, it just seems like it's going to happen year after year with them, with the, you know, non-conference disaster and kind of putting it together later in the year. And, you know, that's fine for their program if they want to make, you know, maybe get like an 11 seed in the NCAA tournament and win a game or two, but it's terrible for the rest of the league when it comes to seeding. They're kind of the inverse Wisconsin, right? Wisconsin usually is fundamentally sound. They win a bunch of games early on, including like this year where they beat us, and then they just don't have the athleticism late in the year once other teams start gelling a little bit. So it's you see this happen every year, and this is why Pac-12 teams always get underseeded and, you know, tend to make some noise in the tournament, whereas the Big Ten, these teams tend to flame out because they're just they don't have the athleticism, but they consistently get good seeds year in, year out.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Oregon's going to do the exact same thing next season when they're bringing in Mookie Betts and not Mookie Betts, what's his name, what is
Mookie Cook
and they're losing Will Richardson. And they're going to struggle to find themselves, and they're going to lose a whole bunch of games outside of conference. By the time conference play gets going, they're going to be, you know, dynamite. So, you know, you can already see it coming for next season. Speaking of all that, I think maybe we should just really quickly transition now into these tweets that went up yesterday by a kind of a popular online account known as MHVR3. Now, so it's capital M, capital H, VER3. He started tweeting about what's going on with the remainder of the 10 remaining Pac-12 teams on their media rights deal. And although you don't know for sure if he's as, you know, if he's dialed in as he appears, he acts like, I mean, I think he did talk about USC and UCLA leaving for the Big Ten before that broke. What he's saying rings true. So his basic premise is that ESPN made an offer of $250 million per year for the remaining 10 teams. So that'd be a $25 million per team split, which is going to be, it's going to end up being less than one third of what SC makes in the Big Ten for those remaining 10 teams. And the conference basically said, no, we're going to keep looking. We're going to keep looking for a better deal. Amazon stepped forward with a deal that was $100 million for like the best game of the week. And left the remaining games untouched, and those would sell, they thought, he thought, for 150 million. So they would be the exact same economics. It's just the visibility would be less because the games, the top tier games would all be on Amazon. Which, you know, everyone pretty much has Amazon these days, but bars don't have Amazon on their TVs. So apparently the six more prominent or more desirable of the remaining 10 teams, which are the two you know, Pacific Northwest teams, Oregon and Washington, along with the Four Corner schools, the two Arizona schools, Colorado, Utah, are basically saying, we want none of this unless you give us a really hefty incentive. You know, that essentially there's not parity amongst revenue on revenue split, that they get a much bigger share than the other schools. He said that Washington needs $35 million a year just to break even for their athletic department, or else they're going to have to start making serious cuts. Now, I don't know if all this is true, but it does ring true. And he is suggesting that this is going to lead to essentially mass exodus from the remaining 10 teams going and joining up with the Big 12, which obviously is losing Oklahoma and Texas, bringing in Cincinnati, Houston, UCF, and what's the fourth team they're bringing in?
Was it BYU?
BYU. So that would be create a very large conference, but the economics would actually make sense, and that they would all, that is a conference where everyone would split about $35 million. So I don't know if this guy is spot on. He's true, but a lot of the same stories are out there. Certainly the story recently that essentially Comcast had overpaid to the tune of $50 million for what was owed on the licensing deal over the course of the contract, and that the Pac-12 knew about this as well and just kind of left kept it hidden. They had to fire their CFO as a result. So that $50 million needs to be repaid. That I've heard has caused Amazon to back off, a lot of people to back off, see how it plays out. So I guess my the way I'm landing on this is, it's a good thing we got out early when we did. This thing looks like a disaster, absolute disaster. I do not see how the Pac-10 or whatever it's going to be called, the Pac, sticks around after next season. I actually think that might be a good thing for us because there won't be this like hostility from the other schools necessarily directed toward us. If like Oregon, Washington are able to escape to the Big 12 and get their $35 million a year, which is what they would have gotten if USC and UCLA stuck around in the Pac-12. So there's a lot there, but I don't know. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think there will be a pack after next season?
I don't see it. I mean, maybe they can pull it off with unequal revenue sharing, but you know, when the pie is that small, right? When you're talking about $25 million a school, for Oregon to get 35, you'd have to have the Oregon States of the world taking 15. And I mean, maybe that happens, but that's just it's hard for me to see it, right? A little bit of background to you on this MHBER3 guy. He does have 15,000 Twitter followers, and he has posted a lot of credible information on conference realignment in the past. So I totally buy this. Do you think, you know, ESPN, they offered the 25 million for the Pac-12, right? It seems like they have no competitive second place bidder. Could they just reduce that to to 20 million, do you think, their offer?
I mean, I think it's possible. I think that it's going to matter for them. The reason they may not do it is if they want to keep the pack alive for the Rose Bowl affiliation, for whenever that might make sense, or for the college football playoff automatic bid, because that will go away. Those are really kind of the right. only two assets that the pack really has, is that national tie to the Rose Bowl, which without SC and UCLA, it's not really the same kind of thing. And the automatic bid to the college football playoff, which is probably the biggest asset with the expansion to 12 teams. So if they think that's valuable, maybe they'll keep the offer up, but maybe they'll think it's not all that valuable and think, because they've already got their fingers in with the Big 12, right? So I just don't know. I don't know if they will think it's worth it. Did they think that they're the only bidder? They don't have to be the only bidder. I mean, the thing is that there are, in the case of college football, there's actually, you know, there are other organizations that are set up that could probably take this if they wanted to. And I don't know if Box would think, gosh, maybe it's worth it just to come and swoop in at the last second and snatch this up for 250. And then we've got another automatic qualifier for the college football playoff. I don't know if they'll view that as worth it. I think they, you know, the Friday night football thing, I think they think they can get done on the Big Ten. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if ESPN would lower its offer. It's possible though. It's definitely possible. And I think that it's the result here is going to be that, in my mind, that these other schools have just got to affiliate themselves somehow with the Big 12. I don't see any other way this comes out.
Yeah, one kind of semi-related note that I do want to make, just yet another benefit of getting out of the Pac-12. I just know with this slate this week, right, we had in my time zone, so I'm in Central Time Zone, we had an 8:30 tip-off against Washington on FS1, and then the Thursday one, I think, was a 10 o'clock Central tip-off. So then, you know, I've got some family on the East Coast trying to watch the game, and you know, they hear it's at 11 o'clock Eastern time on the Pac-12 network. Just forget it, right? Just having the FS1 at 8:30 my time seemed like a minor miracle. And you know, I know people in Houston that are just like, oh, we're gonna watch the first half and record the second half just because we need to go to bed. So just getting into those early time slots with actual viewership, and this goes for football too, right? It's not just basketball, will be such a boost to the athletic department as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's talk maybe some national games. I mean, there's a really amazing slate of games yesterday. There's some interesting results, right? So the number one team in the nation, Purdue, this was such a crazy season, right? They're playing the number 21 team in the country on the road, but that team is 100 miles away, and yet they're a 1-point dog going on this game. So the number one team in the nation is a dog, because they have to travel 100 miles to play a team that's not even in the top 20. They lose. They were down 15.5. They made a comeback. Edie looked tremendous, but it wasn't enough. Indiana wins. I think we were talking offline, just based upon that, you know, who's the true number one right now? I mean, if we lined up everyone on a neutral court, who would Vegas say is number one? I think you picked Houston. I wouldn't argue against that. Although Houston struggled a little bit with Shaw State yesterday. I think maybe Arizona would be, I don't know. Maybe Texas would have an argument. Alabama would have an argument, maybe, even though Alabama lost by whatever 30 points in Norman last week. It's really up for grabs out there. Gonzaga lost to St. Mary's in overtime last night, and like the nightcap, and Virginia lost on the road at Virginia Tech. I mean, it's a road game, but it's like, you know, it's 100 miles and they lost.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is just, I mean, TCU lost again. Kansas lost again. It's kind of a free for all out there, and you know, I think you take a team like UCLA, they won by 24 against Washington State. They're going to have an argument that they're the best team. And I think a team like Arizona can say, look, we can beat anybody. So certainly if you look at the top eight in KenPom, you have St. Mary's, you have Marquette, who I don't think is scaring. And even though they played very well this season, I don't think they're scaring anybody. And you've got Connecticut, which is, won the last couple of games against DePaul and Georgetown, but before that had lost four or five games. And that's your top eight teams. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, and it kind of bears out in the numbers when you compare these adjusted efficiencies to prior years. So, for example, USC's Elite Eight team has a higher rating in KenPom than any team this year currently except Houston. So KenPom would have that USC team at number two. And like that SC team was very good, not perfect, but they were flawed in areas as well, but they can certainly compete with anybody. And I kind of like where we're at with it too, right? Like the current team, the trajectory is good. We had, just a really off shooting nights. We were 4-22 last night from three, and being able to win when you're just really cold from the outside is huge, right? Because you're going to have a game in March where you just aren't making threes and you have to scrap and claw and find a way to win. Now, like, the level of opponent is going to be better than Washington, of course. But, let's say you go 6-22 from three instead of 4-22. That's still an off night, but you're going to have to find a way and win in other ways. One other thing I think with our team that's interesting, right? So we have the number one offense in conference play in KenPom, even though we're ninth in three-point shooting at 31%. So if you think our actual true shooting level is like 34%, you're probably looking at a top 10 to 20 offense, just given how we've done taking care of the ball. So we're number one in terms of turnover rate on offense and conference play. So that's, we've come a long way there. We weren't great at it in that Washington game, especially Drew and Boogie, but Kobe had five assists, no turnovers. We weren't terrible. So we're the offensive trajectory is definitely in the upward direction. To the point where I think if you start to wonder, is our offense better than our defense? So I guess, Chase, throwing it to you, like, what do you think about kind of our offensive play versus our defensive play right now?
So our biggest problem on defensive play, and this is shown through any number of metrics, but we're number one in the nation, number one in the Pac-12 in conference games, only in 2-point field goal percentage defense. So that's phenomenal. We're 11th in the conference in 3-point percentage defense. You saw that a little bit yesterday with some of the Menifield stuff, but what was causing that, where we're 11th in the conference, defensive rebounding. And right. And that's also playing. That's really the only, I mean, the 3-point shooting defense is not great in all games, but the thing that's really hampering our defense and not making, limiting us from like a top 15 defense is the rebound. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. We're number one in the country in 2-point field goal percentage defense. We're slightly above average, just right on average in guarding the 3-point line. We're above average in forcing turnovers for the first time in however long. But we are near the bottom of the country in defensive rebound. We're basically giving up one out of every three rebounds to the opponents. So that's the issue. Like, how do you quantify that problem, which is a major problem, compared to on offense? What is our shortcoming on offense? Well, the shortcoming on offense is our 3-point shooting. Everything else we do pretty darn well. Not great, but okay. Our offense rebounding is okay. Our 2-point field goal percentage offense shooting is definitely above average. Free throw percentage, above average. Turnovers, definitely, for the season, not as much, but in Pac-12 play, definitely above average. The problem is just that 3-point shooting. So what's a bigger issue in my mind? The rebounding. So I guess maybe our offense is slightly better than our defense. Certainly, I think our offense seems to have a capability with to get hot when Boogie and Drew are hot. That the defense never seems to be super hot rebounding the ball. So we can gets up to it gets up to decent, but it never gets up to hot. So I think potential. I certainly the offense seems to have a higher. We seem to have a better ceiling on offense just because of how hot Drew and Boogie can get shooting the ball. Now, I say all that if some by some miracle our rebound were to come around, our defense would really be stellar. So that's that's the and we can I think we can definitely guard the three when we focus on that. I mean, Washington, we didn't really have to focus on it too much because we knew that they weren't going to be shooting a lot of threes to begin with going into that game. I think for a lot of the second half, they didn't shoot any threes because they were so cold in the first half. So that's I think that's my take. I think the offense has been is right now slightly better than the defense, but I'm willing to change that opinion as if new facts present themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the rebounding is that fixable at this point, whereas I think the 3-point shooting is more random than bad, I guess is what I would say there. But it kind of just, yeah, relating, going back to your question on the national picture in terms of the top of college basketball, I mean, yeah, you still got UConn sitting there at number 6 in KenPom after, really struggling conference play here. And almost losing to Georgetown yesterday too. So they just they're, yeah. I don't know. It's hard to trust them. So it's the kind of year where even if SC gets into like an 8-9, or if they're an 8 or 9 seed, they'd have a shot in the second round. We'll see. I mean, hopefully we end up better than that and can get like up to the 6th line. I think that would be great. And give you a path, kind of like we had in that Elite Eight year, to really make some noise. But it's not the kind of year where you have these dominant 1 seeds. I'm just thinking back to that year, where you had like the Wisconsin and the Kentuckys that were just, I think it was 2015, just a top college basketball. Here's a good example. So in 2015, the top 6 KenPom teams were Kentucky, Wisconsin, Duke, Arizona, Villanova, and Virginia. And this is the year where Duke won the title with that Jahlil Okafor and Tyus Jones team. They all had KenPom adjusted efficiencies above 30. And then if you look at this year, no team has one above 30. So in the computer models, the top 6 teams from that year are better than any team in this year. And then I just think just it shows how wide open the sport is, right? I think you mentioned that Houston's the team that you would probably trust the most, and that's where I'm at. Even though they're flawed and are definitely beatable. So you're gonna have, I think, this crazy tournament with lots of upsets, really, especially in that second round, right? I think you're gonna see a lot of like 7s over 2s, maybe some 8s over 1s, definitely, 6s over 3s, and so on from there.
Yeah, so and I was just looking through, the year that this is a little bit like, quite frankly, is the COVID year, where the shutdown year, 2020, where Kansas was like the only like team that was really performing at an elite level. I think they had won their last 16 games of the season or something, just dominated the Big 12. They had, they had Dotson and Azubuike. Who now, now are kind of afterthoughts, and then the rest of the guys were the guys that we would play the next year in the tournament. So I'm not even sure how great that team was, but then you look at the rest of like who were projected to be like the top teams. Like so Gonzaga only had lost 2 games, but they lost to BYU in conference. They had Filip Petrušev, but Timmy, was only playing like half the time. They had Kispert. IEA was. Playing, but wasn't like the level guy we would see later. They just, it was before they had Suggs. That, I mean, there was no really super dominant team. Now, it's funny, those, that Gonzaga team and then Baylor team would come back the next season and beat those dominant teams. But they weren't kind of that year before. And that was the year like Dayton, if you remember, like because of Obi Toppin was like,
Right.
the hot team, and they had won 20 games in a row. And then, even San Diego State was like, I remember watching them because we played a doubleheader at Staples, where we played LSU in the second half. The first half of the doubleheader was them playing Utah, and they just obliterated a pretty decent, I thought, Utah team, and with Malachi Flynn and Matt Mitchell. But again, we're talking like Dayton, San Diego State, Gonzaga, but they're like, they're a Gonzaga team that I don't think they quite had the talent there. West Virginia was like top 10. Creighton was 12. So like that was a very much a, like I think a wide open year. I think this is going to be a very similar thing, assuming we're not going to have another pandemic hit. We're going to have a very wide open tournament, and I just wouldn't looked on the season versus quad one, quad two, according to Torvik, Houston number one, Connecticut number two, St. Mary's number three. Now, is anybody terrified of playing Connecticut or St. Mary's in the tournament? And yet these are the
No.
number two and three teams on the season in quad first quad one, quad two. USC, by the way, is number 29 in that ranking. I don't think, quite frankly, not that much. I mean, perfect example. St. Mary's is number three, USC is number 29. You put them on a neutral court in 5 days' time. Who's going to win that game? I mean, St. Mary's might be favored, but I don't think a lot of people think, oh, SC's not going to win. I think a lot of people think, oh, SC might win that game.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like it is a super bizarre random year. And Houston may be that team, but as good as they are, and I love how they play and how good they are, they're not super talented, right? I mean, it's not like they've got Jarius Walker and they've got Sasser, but not guys that we're thinking, oh God, there's just no, we have we're we've got no answers for these guys. There's no teams this year. I feel like, oh, we got no answers for these guys. I feel like everybody's going to have some sort of answers for almost anyone you put on the court in front of them, and this is going to be a super, super weird year when we get to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, like even Alabama, which is heralded as like the talented, long athletic team. I mean, Clowney hasn't shot well from three this year. And Brandon Miller, I mean, he's exceptional. But can he keep the 44% from three up into the tournament? I think that's a question. Just given, how rare of a comp how he's in such rare air as a freshman with that percentage. So we'll see there, and they've got that game against Oklahoma where they got absolutely blitzed. So they've come back to earth a little bit, it seems like. But yeah, it's we'll see. It'll be very, very intriguing.
By the
Another
way,
quote,
just
yeah.
really quickly, versus against quad one, quad two teams since the start of December, so after Thanksgiving Day, since December 1st, number one UCLA, number three Arizona. So
Yep.
USC is number 30th on that, is 30, and they're the only team in the top, the only three in the top 55 or so in the Pac-12. Houston number two. So yeah, UCLA, Houston, Arizona. I think that's a pretty good. I think that would be where I would start looking, right? UCLA, Houston, Arizona, Tennessee number four, then Purdue number five. That's versus quad one, quad two since December one. Yeah, that might be
Yeah.
a good metric. Okay, sorry, I
Yeah.
interrupted.
Cool. So I think we've covered that. Do you want to close with a few questions from David here that we have from the board?
Yes, why don't you read them off because they're not in front of me right now.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So number one, and these were before the Washington State game. So thanks, David, for sending these in. Any insight into whether Vince comes back next year? He shows glimmers of being a huge force if we have him for a sophomore year.
So I think my answer to that question is what happened in yesterday's game, right? The problem is for Vince is the NBA has changed, and bigs are not valued the way they used to be. He is going to, if he were to enter the draft, he's competing not just against guys like Hawkez and like even Bona. He's competing against guys like Timmy and Tubelis and Shibway and Gay and the guy who left Abigidi, who's you know trying to make a play. By the way, I don't know if you saw this, like Abigidi's numbers for the Ignite. He's like playing. They've only, first of all, the Ignite's only played like 12 games this season, and he's averaging 3 points a game. So that was like a weird thing. But yeah, Vince is up against too many different guys, I think, at this point, and he's got way too much to prove. I mean, look, he's flashed, but he's got way too much to prove at this point to, I think, any NBA team to take him seriously. Now, maybe he'll just completely blow up in the NCAA tournament or something where everyone sees him, and that's definitely a possibility. But there are so many high-quality bigs, and it's so hard for them to get any kind of traction. I mean, look at Lively for Duke. I mean, he's now off draft boards. I think they're saying he's not even going to get drafted, and he was like – what, number two player coming into this year?
Number one.
And he had a huge game yesterday, right? Against North Carolina. Of course, his version of a huge game is 3 points or 5 points, but just the rebounding and the block shots was all you can really expect from him. And speaking of North Carolina, you have Baycott. I mean, there's so many. College basketball has not had this many high quality bigs. Basically, I think since like the early 90s, since guys started leaving early, mainly because they're just not valued by the NBA any longer. So that's my answer. What's your answer to that question?
Yeah, I agree. I'd be really surprised. The other thing is just positional versatility, right? Like, let's take Big O with the Atlanta Hawks, for example, right? Like, it's taken him like several years to really get starters minutes there because he's been behind Clint Capela, and Clint Capela is really good and like 30 years old. And, he can only play center, and Big O can only play center. Right. So, and he was super good at USC, right. He goes sixth in the draft, and, he's been good in his minutes, but unless you can play multiple positions, it's just really tough. It's kind of like the lead guard spot too, right? Like the wings are so interchangeable because you can play them like 2, 3, 4, right? If they can, guard multiple positions and be versatile enough, whereas the bigs and the point guards, it's just a much higher bar to get starters minutes in the NBA. So I think he needs another year at tape.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Okay.
So next question. And this is interesting given what we saw last night. Do you see Kajani as eventually being an above average regular, or does he seem more like transfer material to you?
Well, I don't think there's a desire to have him transfer. Let me start out with that. I mean, for a variety of reasons. I think he's a really good kid that the coaches really like. He's got a couple issues. One, he's a little bit undersized. Two, he doesn't have great hands. And that's kind of going to be the thing that's going to hurt him at his size. And three, he's not bouncy, He got a ball passed to him against Washington State where he got ahead of the defender, broke to the through the key, got the ball passed, which is, he did the exact right thing. But once he got it, he couldn't finish. And he ended up, I think, throwing the ball through the bottom of the rim. Some of that can be cured, I think, just with being more crafty and kind of, just getting better over time, and hopefully his hands improve. Some of it, he's going to have a ceiling. I think he's for sure a four-year player, no matter what ends up happening to him. I hope I actually hope that he sticks around, because I do think, even though there's other aspects of the game which are lacking, including that his hands on his rebounding is not strong, and he's lacked some of the instincts that like Hornery has. He's on man-to-man defense. I think he's better than like the other guys we have as a backup to Joshua and to Vince. So I think he's a four-year player. I would expect that they want like him to stick around, but I think we need to temper expectations for him.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he does have a pretty good stroke. I actually think that he should just watch Isaiah Mobley's tape from his junior year. And I don't think he has like the physical tools that Isaiah has, but just to kind of like, strive to be that level, player where you can hit a wide open three, You can get contested rebounds, and then maybe like have the occasional post touch and jump hook from there. But I think what made him really great in high school was just his rebounding ability. He was awesome on the glass, especially the offensive glass. I think you're seeing that a little bit this year, where his offensive rebounding has been better than his defensive rebounding. But yeah, definitely, seems like an awesome kid, and hope he sticks around for sure.
Okay, what do we got next?
Okay, so we got one more here. If Vince comes back along with Trey, Kobe, Reese, and the freshmen, aren't we one portal sharpshooter from being a Final Four threat?
Okay, are we one portal sharpshooter away? I've been thinking a lot about this. First off, I think part of the issue is going to be what position on the court does that sharpshooter play? I think there will be a lot of tension about bringing in another a pure shooting guard, because not only are we bringing in Isaiah Collier, we're bringing in Silas Demery, who's kind of coming in on the assumption that he's going to get minutes playing at the two along with Isaiah. And then we have this kind of like, the Reese, Malik, Ozias Sellers situation at the two. There's not a lot of spots on the roster. There's not a lot of floor time available for another shooting guard. But at the same time, I completely agree. We do need another shooter. So I don't know if we bring in kind of more of a four that can shoot. That might be something to look at. But yeah, I agree. I agree with the premise. I'm not even sure we would need some. I think we could, if we just brought the roster back as it is, we might be a Final Four threat on its own. But yeah, for just helping out when we need, need help on shooting in certain spots, it would be good to have another shooter. I'm just not sure exactly how that fits in with the roster construction we have, because we have all these twos that we're hoping are going to improve their shooting, and they're just not shooting great from the outside this season.
Yeah, I think you might need to lose one shooting guard as it is from the current roster just to make all the minutes work and such. So I would look at like a combo forward kind of as more of your transfer candidate. Definitely like a shooting from that position would be a plus. If you can get rebounding from that position, I think that'd be a plus too. A guy like Matthew Cleveland at Florida State, I have no idea if he's going to enter the portal, but someone like that who can rebound and has shown shooting potential and, has the length that we have built our roster around in recent years. Even someone like Tyson Degenhardt at Boise State, again, no clue if he enters the portal, but just really skilled, great touch, with some positional size. As well. So I think there will be options out there. But given that you're losing Drew and Drew's played so many minutes this year, there is kind of a void in that spot that I'm not sure you want to fully bet on like Kajani and Arrington Page filling that, right away.
Yeah, and I think this also goes back a little bit to the discussion we had earlier about what's our more pressing a deficiency right now. Is it the 3-point shooting, or is it the defensive rebounding? And I think I'd rather, get a guy that could. I mean, I think you want to fill that slot with somebody who for sure can rebound. And even though we're bringing another big and we're bringing back these guys potentially, and we have a lot of bigs on the roster, I still think, they have not proven themselves to be consistent, reliable rebounders. And other than like, Trey and Kobe are like two best rebounders, and it would be really nice if we gave them some rebounding support. So if we can find a guy to rebound and shoot, that'd be great. But I don't think that's going to be a guard, is my opinion.
Yep, completely agree.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else before we get out of here?
That's all I got.
All right. Well, we'll probably try to have another one before the game against Oregon. So until then, everyone, fight on.
Right on.